Let's do it.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of Recovery in the Middle Ages. My name is Mike R.
And I'm Nat X, and this is Recovery in the Middle Ages, a podcast about two suburban middle-aged men in their pursuit of life, love, and recovery.
Are we pursuing love? That'll be news to my wife.
Yeah. Mostly, I try. I really do. I try.
You mean love with a big L.
That's it. Oh, yeah. That's it. Love.
Yeah.
Big love.
So, crazy week, huh?
Yeah, this is great. We're on episode number 2, and we released the first episode, and it was funny because, you know, we don't have, obviously, a lot of listeners, and so the people listening to our show are mostly our friends and family. And, right. And I had made a comment in the last show about my wife not caring or being interested in anything creative, and wouldn't be my luck, but she said, oh, I want to listen to it.
Right.
And she did.
Well, I hope she left us a 5-star review on iTunes.
I highly doubt it. Yeah, we're available on iTunes now.
So I would encourage all of you to go out and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Yeah, please do.
If you don't think we're worth a 5-star review on iTunes, then just don't leave any review on iTunes.
Don't leave a bad review. Yeah, good reviews only.
We're trying to climb up the charts. And I would say that we have dozens of listeners, literally.
We do. I was very pleased. We have a lot of friends out there. The Dopey Nation Facebook group, you know, gave it a listen. I got some good feedback, and I'm very excited to try and follow it up with something worth listening to.
Yeah, that's the struggle, isn't it?
It is a struggle, and you know, listening back to the first episode myself, I think I was happy with the sound quality and not getting too much behind the scenes. But one of the things I noticed was I said like shtick a lot, and my wife even made a comment. She goes, "What's with all the Yiddish?" And did you feel like there was too much Yiddish going on in the first?
You know, as a Long Islander born and raised, right. I did not think the Yiddish was over the top. I thought it was an appropriate amount.
Right. I mean, that's what I think. The shtick, the schnorrer, and the schlemiel, and the schmucks. I mean, they're for the goyim, everybody knows.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be a shonda.
Wow, you really doubling down on that shit.
But yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to say that one of the other things that we talked about in the first show, you know, show notes. Every time I listen to listen to podcasts, they say, check it in the show notes, check it in the show notes. And I was wondering who was going to do the show notes. And lo and behold, I was looking at our Podbean page, and Mike had really nice show notes.
Thank you.
Not only that, but the one comment we did get
I saw
referenced
that.
The show notes.
Yes.
So
I was,
thank God for that.
I felt really validated in my pursuit of show note excellence.
Yeah, we're trying to spread the work around. Otherwise, everything is going a little bit crazy here. Our kids are getting back to school. You know, we both have kids, school-aged children. And I know that my 9-year-old is losing his mind. He's sick of me. He's sick of my wife. And I've completely lost control of anything related to his day. I don't know about you. You and your 10-year-old.
Well, I've been working from home, as you know. So I sit in the living room in front of the computer, poking away all day. And I have listened to probably hundreds of hours of YouTube guys, you know, who, you know, the kind of guys that like fill their house up with like water balloons and then dance around in them and stuff.
I know my kids watch that stuff.
You know, and so now I have my favorites.
They're addicted to it. They're, you know, talk about addiction. You know, there's a definite change in my son's persona after he's been watching TikTok.
Oh, no question about it.
And one of the very few things I agree with our president on is ban TikTok. Please, as soon as possible, and while you're at it, ban YouTube, because it's destroying my children.
TikTok for sure. It would be a lot quieter around the house if there was no TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a Chinese businessman hiding in my closet or not, but it's a nightmare with my kids.
Probably in your phone.
Probably. Your kid's phone. And that's fine because there's nothing going on here. Nothing at all.
Right. Nothing to see.
I just wanted to make a note. We've got a very special, some places in the country call it a birthday. On the East Coast here, we called it an anniversary.
Oh, right.
So Mike has, a few days ago, is celebrating 1 year.
1 year.
1 year sober. Mm-hmm. Is that just from alcohol, or are we including meth, crack, and heroin?
Oh, shit. Really?
Yeah, it counts. And by the way, marijuana counts, so
yeah, no,
you've
no.
got it all.
Yeah.
You nailed it.
I'm good. Drugs were really, for me, a bit more in the past. Alcohol was definitely the thing that precipitated my my journey to sobriety this time around.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I have a similar path here. Years ago, not as many as you, I had a nasty heroin addiction. Nasty.
Is there another kind?
I don't know. I feel like some people do heroin like a gentleman. You know
what I mean? Right. You know, silver spoons and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they're living the life. But for me, it was not. I had a nasty heroin addiction. But the long and short of it is I was able to overcome it with, and we'll get into how I got over heroin. But the important part is after I had overcome it, I discovered that, hey, wow, alcohol kind of gives me a similar feeling. Mm. And I was able to stop at the gas station on the way to work, pick up a tall boy, drink one or two of them, and I noticed that I was able to get the similar kind of escape that, I mean, look, alcohol, it's hard to make a comparison to heroin, but for me, it's not. It was giving me that same kind of escape. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can relate to this. And what I found was it really escalated to a point where I had a DWI, which landed me into hopefully it was my final time in recovery, inpatient, outpatient, probation, and the whole thing. So and I think for me, as it was for you, the alcohol, if you don't drink, you won't call your coke dealer. If you don't drink, you don't call your dope dealer. Is that what you experienced?
Your journey and my journey are somewhat different. I had sort of settled into, over the last few years, a fairly comfortable habit of a sort of middle-class suburban lawyer professional where I was going to a lot of work conferences. I was going to a lot of work dinners. So there was a lot of drinking. And you know, it's funny. We've had this conversation offline. You know, I think I mentioned to you that there's a lot of lawyers drink a lot. And you were in finance and you're like, you know, finance people drink a lot.
And then
I talked to people in advertising. You're like, yeah, God, everybody's a boozer.
Everybody in advertising yeah. drinks a lot.
You know, what's the common thread that's running through all that, right?
Who works drinks a lot. Everybody who doesn't work drinks a lot.
But it's sort of the normalization of alcohol in these industries.
Absolutely.
Right? So, you know, I traveled a lot for work. I fly around the country. I do a lot of, you know, legally things here and there.
Legally, right? Yeah.
Without getting too into it. But, you know, most of those are accompanied by dinners and dinners or some kind of, you know, maybe there's golf or maybe there's a night at a sporting event or something. So, you know, I found myself, you know, when I was at those things, I was drinking quite a bit, you know, and then the next day I would have to get up and do the thing that I flew to, like, you know,
right, it makes
Wisconsin
you wonder,
to do. You know?
How is everybody you were drinking with doing it? You know, that's what I always thought. How come I'm the only one waking up unable to function unless I have a drink at 6 a.m.
Well, you know, and I don't know if they felt as shitty as I did, but I certainly didn't feel great on a lot of those mornings, you know.
No.
You know, I'd fly to California and I'd have to deal with the time change as well and all that kind of thing. So, you know, I've been working at this job for 12 years and, you know, for the first 11 of them, that was pretty much the pattern. And, you know, when I'd come home, I wasn't necessarily a big drinker at home, but I was a very consistent drinker.
Right. Consistency is important.
Yeah. I mean, get a bottle of wine every night, you know, and there's how many glasses in a bottle of wine? Like
I
five?
No, just one for me.
One big one.
One big glass.
But, you know, so, you know, my wife and I would, you know, split a bottle of wine, and, you know, there's an odd number of glasses in a bottle of wine. Say there's five. Well, you know, how much time did I spend angling on how to get that third glass, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then of course on the weekends you'd have a few more. And then if you went to a concert or something, there'd be, you know, it'd just be like the, all bets were off, you know, just start pouring it down.
Right.
And you know, was I functional? Sure. Was I doing a good job at work? Yes, I was. Was I having, serious concerns inside of my own mind about how things were going with me? Absolutely. I mean, I felt like I wasn't living my full authentic life. I wasn't present in my life.
Right. You know? And you know, anybody who has been a functional alcoholic, and I think back on, I was sitting there with my probation officer, early on in my probation. And I remember him saying to me, you know something, you're a functional alcoholic. And I said to him, I said, really? I said, you think I'm functional? I took that as a compliment.
Thank
that
you.
He thought, looking at my life, that I was functional, because I had really thought that I wasn't. You know, but so you have a year sober, clean, however you want to call it. So 1 year ago, a couple days ago, you know, what was it that... that made you want to stop? Did you see something on TV? Did you read something? Did you have a spiritual experience like we hear about so much? Did God touch you on the forehead with a magic wand and sparkles and light fell over you and you just never wanted to drink again? I mean, what happened?
No sparkles.
No God sparkles.
No God sparkles.
Sorry.
You know, this was something, you know, Quitting is easy. I've done it 1,000 times.
Right. I'm an expert.
So, you know, there have been times over the last few years where I've, you know, kind of ginned myself up.
No pun intended.
Yeah. No. Well, maybe the pun was intended.
Vodka, I don't know. Or scotch, gin. Go on.
Yeah. I missed it. All right. I'm going to do it late anyway.
Yeah.
God damn it again. Here we go.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Finally.
We got it.
Yeah. You know, we have a very limited budget for sound effects.
Roadcaster Pro.
So I'm blowing the whole budget for the podcast.
Here it is.
So, you know, but what I noticed was, you know, because I wasn't really, you know, listen, in my past, I've certainly had years, and we'll get into this as time goes on, but there's been a few precipitating events in my life that have really sent me off the rails, and I've lost some good years, you know, at a much deeper level of alcohol use than in the last, say, decade. But what I did notice is anytime I would ever try to stop for any period of time, it was extremely difficult. I would get a couple of days in, 3 days, and then I'd have a drink, and then it would be like another year before I could muster up the energy or the strength or the will or whatever you want to call it to give it another shot.
Were you experiencing like physical withdrawals, or was it strictly all psychological?
Well, that's an interesting point, because I do remember over the years a few times, you know, when I was mostly confining my drinking to Friday or Saturday nights, where I would go out and I would get absolutely shit-faced. And then on Monday and Tuesday, it would just suck. It would be like withdrawal, hangover, you know, for like 2-3 days, and then start, you know, rinse and repeat, start over again on Thursday. Right. And at some point it did get into my head like, well, this is insanity. Like, why are you doing this? Because every week it's like quitting smoking every week. Like, why?
Why keep quitting? Just keep drinking, right. You know?
But, you know, I was younger then when this sort of stuff was going through my head. And I'll tell you, I think it is a lot harder as a young person who with a much more active social life than I have now, sitting out here in the suburbs, to turn down all the invitations to sort of isolate yourself socially. I mean, the good news, I guess, is that not drinking is more acceptable now than it was even 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very true. And I had forgotten about this because, we had pushed our recording date back a couple of days. And a couple of days ago when we were supposed to record, I had a lot of great ideas. And now they're just coming back to me. Over the weekend, we had one of my son's friends' families over the house for, I don't know, like it's just one of his best friends and the parents are like pretty cool, but we don't know them. So we invited them over. Long story short, of course, we served alcohol. I don't have a dry household anymore. Mm-hmm. We did for a while, but we don't anymore. And I had a tall glass of water, you know, when our guests came in. It's just a dad and a mom and the two kids. And we're like, you know, what can I get you to drink, you know? And the dad is looking at my, I don't know, it's like a 16-ounce glass with ice and water. And he goes, oh, I think I'll have what he's having.
This guy's a heavy hitter.
Right? He's looking at me going, okay, I'm going to have fun tonight. And I'm saying, no, no, no. Like, you don't want this. No, no, no. This is water. You don't understand. You don't want any of this. You want this craft beer my wife bought for you. And it was pretty funny, you know, and it was sort of like, you can see the sort of the quizzical, you know, expression on their faces when they begin to realize that, like, why is this guy not drinking? Like, what is going on?
And isn't that weird?
It is. Like, there's really, because I used to do that too when I was younger, and occasionally someone would be like, no, thank you. And I would look at them like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, what am I missing? You know, right? Is he a Mennonite or Amish? I don't know. Maybe the Amish.
Where have I heard that? I the expression that alcohol is the only drug you have to justify not doing.
Hey, that's a good one. Yeah. You know, and the night went on, and I had no problem having fun. You know, one thing I do, and Recovery Elevator talks about this a lot, like, what's your non-alcoholic beverage? Mm-hmm. Mine is the Mexican Coca-Cola, which the difference is that they use sugar cane instead of fructose corn syrup or something like that. And that's what I do. I'm drinking those all night. And then we were having a conversation when they were leaving, because we were talking, as everybody does, in the kitchen on the way out. And somehow diet came up and getting fat over the pandemic. And then the dad says to me something like, you could tell he was trying to, like, work in a question and figure out what the hell was going on with me and why I'm not drinking. And he's like, do you drink? And I got a straight. I said, yeah. I said, no, not for a long time. You know, I said, I don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and it really, that was it. And I have a good feeling that I'll never hear about it again from that particular person. And that's what I've found with other, like, dads, like you and other people I've met. I really only have to say once that, you know, one of my good jokes is, you know, I'm allergic to alcohol. If I drink it, I break out in handcuffs. And I, yes, thank
Nailed
you.
Nailed that one.
Nailed it. That was good. And I don't usually get another question. And people are cool about it. It's not like in high school, right, college, where, what, you don't drink, man? What the hell? And then people are giving you a hard time. So, you know, it's a little easier, I guess you would say, in some ways, to be at a non-drinker, in the situation we're in.
Yeah. You know, law firm culture was also like that. You go to the, you know, everybody would celebrate or commiserate, whatever it is. Right. It would always take place at the Irish bar across the street.
Drink. Are you sad? Right. Drink.
But I don't know how I would have navigated that. You know, now at my age, people are maybe not so interested in what I'm putting into my mouth, you know.
Right. They just want to know how much you recovered for them.
Yeah, well, but I will say this, you know, the first, I had a few work conferences to go to in the first 30 days after I got sober, and that was really eye-opening. One thing I realized was I didn't feel like I was necessary for me to discuss reasons or why, you know, if it did come up. So I just made sure I got there first. I usually got there first so I could get to the bar and drink like two or three drinks before anybody else got there.
Right. Yeah,
now I got there to sort of...
get your Diet Coke first.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right. Well, you know, and here's the tip for you business folks who are looking to quit and still fly under the radar. You ask for a ginger ale in a rocks glass with a twist of lemon and a swizzle stick, which looks exactly like some kind of scotch drink.
Right? Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
It is a good one.
You're hiding.
So you go
your
back
sobriety.
And you sip on that. The problem is nobody's going to sip a ginger ale like that. So no. I was pounding these fuckers. I was drinking like five of them in a row, like within an hour. And I was getting some weird looks from people.
Like, man, he's wasted.
Right. And they're like, man, that guy can hold his shit.
Yeah. He must drink a lot.
Yeah. But I mean, that was kind of fun. you know, it's almost like acting, like playing a role.
Yeah, you're playing a role. And so, but like, what did you do? Did you, of course you went to an AA meeting, right? You got a sponsor, you raised your hand, right? And then, somebody took you under their wing, walked you through the steps. You went to 90 meeting in 90 days. You read the big book. Mm-hmm. You did all that, right?
Yeah, I didn't do any of that.
You didn't do that. Oh.
I mean, I did that in 1993.
You didn't do that this time?
Not this time.
How are you still sober? How's that possible?
Right? Really, you know, by some definitions, I'm just white knuckling it.
You are white knuckling. You are a dry drunk.
That's it. except I feel like no desire to drink, which is, you know, so I don't know.
You're probably just lying to yourself.
That's got to be it. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll talk about that in a second, but let me circle back to the circumstances that got me to stop in the first place.
Please do.
Besides, you know, that feeling of, you know, occasional feeling of loathing and self-hatred after a bad night. So the family and I rented a cabin up in Woodstock. This was the last weekend I had anything to drink. So we went up there, and the first night we were there, my wife and I were drinking wine, and she was drinking a normal, civilized human amount of wine.
Like a glass and a half.
Yeah.
Left some on the table.
I was just going to town on this, and it was a little over the top. We started to play some family Monopoly and so on, and by the end of that game, I was just not, you know, I was so out of it.
Just on another planet.
Know? And the thing is, you know, I hide my shit pretty good, so I don't, you know, my kids have never really seen me falling down drunk. They've never, you know.
Yeah, me too.
Thank
God for that. I was nice, Daddy, when I was drinking.
Yeah.
What happened to Daddy? Why is he mean now? Right. Daddy stopped drinking.
Yeah. So I was never a mean drunk. No. I'm always very gregarious. You
right.
Know? But you know, I woke up the next morning just feeling like the bottom of somebody's shoe, and you know, we had this whole day of hiking plan and stuff, and I was able to do it, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I would have had I not been. And I've had periods of sobriety in the past. Some of them, you know, I wouldn't say a continuous year. This is probably the longest I've gone. I've strung together months, you know, sometimes close to a year. But you know, I did not want to go through life with my family, like just being half present, either because I was hungover or because I had too much to drink the night before, because I believe I won that Monopoly game, but thing is, I don't remember
it. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think of those same things when I'm on vacation these days. I use that same word when I'm talking to myself, as I often do, present. I feel present with my kids, because I remember, you know, when I was doing heroin, and I was either, you know, coming off or looking for more, but I never had energy. And honestly, it was the same for heroin withdrawal that it was for drinking. Just that sense of not being present. And one of the things, you know, even though like these days being present means my kids are driving me insane and I don't know what to do, but at least I'm there, you know, mentally present, and I can cope with it in some way. And just the feeling of being able to have energy, you know, at 6 or 7 in the morning when my 6-year-old wakes up, you know, I can be there. I can be daddy, and I'm not like on another planet, you know, texting someone to get something dropped off or thinking about when the liquor store opens at 10 o'clock. How am I going to, you know, tell my wife I've got to go out, make up a story, and you know, I did all that stuff. So just being able to be present and having fun on a vacation, I mean, that's a miracle to me. It's a miracle, you know, to be able to do that, just to be present.
Yeah,
you know,
I was in 7-Eleven the other morning after I finished a run, and there was a guy in there. This was like 7:30 in the morning, and he had like 3 tall boys of wasn't anything good.
Bud ice.
Yeah, something like that.
I saw something like that this morning, too.
You know, I just felt so bad for that guy, you know?
You know the local drunk guy that everybody knows? He passes out in front of my store.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody knows him in town. Every town has a couple of these guys. This poor guy, I feel for him. But he looked pretty chipper. It was like, you know, 9:30 this morning. I went to go fill up on gas, and there he is. I'm like, oh, there's, you know, so-and-so. I wonder what he's getting. And then I was getting gas, and I just had to be a voyeur, and I'm like, I'm just going to watch. And I sat there getting my gas, and I'm watching him. He only got like 5 Bud Ice.
Right, only 5.
But like 5 Bud Ice tall boys. So yeah. If you ever wonder what those guys go for, I mean, that's it. You know,
well, it's bang for your buck.
And but where does he's getting the money? Like, I know he doesn't work. I see him sleeping, you know, it's amazing. But I thought that same thing. I'm like, man, I'm like, thank God I'm not in that spot where I am, you know, first thing in the morning, I'm feeling good and going to pick up my my tall boys for the day. And,
right.
You know, and it makes you feel sad. And you wish you could do something for people like that. And somebody can maybe, but it's not me.
Alcohol is one of those things where if you're not sitting there questioning your relationship with it, it's kind of hard for someone to drag you somewhere where and force you to do it.
Yeah, you know? I had a revelation at some point.
I mean, the judge could always force you to confront
your
relationship.
The judge has worked with me very closely over the years, but to just realize that alcohol was not my problem. Drugs were not my problem. Mm-hmm. They were my solution. And I only really came to terms with that after one of the things I used to do to try and get and stay clean was listen to speaker tapes. Mm-hmm. They're obviously not tapes. It's on a smartphone. But a lot of the people who were speaking on those recordings would say things like that. Like, hi, my name is Nat. My name and my problem Hi, I'm an addict. My name and my problem is Nat. You know, you're the problem. Alcohol was your solution. And when your solution stops working and starts ruining your life, it's time to look at that and make a change.
See, that's interesting. I wake up the next day after my last drink. I decide I'm going to throw myself into this project, right? The project of not drinking anymore.
Right.
So I go out there and I get my resources lined up. You know, I go to the podcast world. Download every recovery podcast out there, and I figure I'll sort through them, and the ones that are not for me, I'll get rid of.
You didn't email Dr. Drew?
No, I did not.
Okay. Yeah.
So I went out, you know, I got the podcast thing going, and then I got a couple of books. And, you know, I'd read The Big Book years ago, and I you know, anytime I'd had a relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a few times over the years, it really didn't, it didn't sit right with me. I tried different meetings. I mean, I was actually out here. I lived in this New York City for like 20 years, but there was a period when I was back here for a little while. And I think I went to every meeting on the North Shore of Long Island for 90 days. And I just could not find a place where I felt, you know, at home, you know, in terms of type of meeting. And I had a sponsor. I tell you, I had a weird sponsor the first, because, you know, I was into the Grateful Dead. I'm still into the Grateful Dead, right? So I found a sponsor in one of the AA meetings who was also a Deadhead. And, you know, he was very sort of, he had one of those, he had kind of crazy eyes. You know, the eyes are just kind of boring into you. And you're kind of like, well, okay, maybe this guy knows what he's doing. So I start working the steps
crazy
with him.
Crazy
It quickly becomes apparent to me that there's something like not all there about this guy. You know? But he's the sponsor. So I'm
that
listening to him.
Could be genius, though. You never
right.
know.
Right, I know. Or the Buddhists call it crazy wisdom, yeah. right? You know, so maybe
plenty
this guy's.
Crazy wisdom.
But he kept calling me up and trying to get me to go to shows, you know, and I was like, I don't know if I want to go to a show yet. You know?
A
like,
show?
Like Dead Show or Jam Band related thing. And I'm like,
okay, Jam Band.
I'm like, you know, I said, you know, I'm no expert, but maybe putting me in a parking lot where everybody else there is doing drugs is probably not what I need right now.
There is a sober community in the Dead.
Yes, the Wharf Rats.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've heard about that.
Yes.
I'm not
great
a
group of
myself,
people.
But
great
yeah.
group of people.
They
you'd see them at shows. They have tables with yellow balloons, so you can easily find them.
Right, that's
in
cool.
Crowd of spaced out hippies. So anyway, I dropped that guy, but well, he dropped me. He got very, very mad and annoyed, and said, "You know, if you're not going to work the program," and I'm like, "Is working going to a Dead show is working the program?" Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I am in the right place.
What program is this?
Yeah. So I don't know. So anyway, long story short. I got a couple books. One of the books I got was, the first book I read was called Alcohol Explained by William Porter.
Mm.
William Porter is a British paratrooper. He was in the British military, started drinking a lot, eventually quit drinking, and then wrote a book about it. And his book sort of takes a very scientific approach to alcohol. And You were saying how you go into these meetings and you say, my problem, you know.
My name and my problem is Ned.
Right.
Right.
Now, what Porter says is, you know, at least in terms of alcohol, alcohol itself causes depression. And
This Naked Mind was talking about that as well.
It's like the only way to relieve the depression if you're a drinker is by drinking. So, you know, he says the irony is that drinkers spend thousands of dollars on expensive counseling to work out why they're so unhappy so they can stop drinking. But in fact, it's the drinking that's making them unhappy. So you can, it's only when you stop drinking, you let the effects of the alcohol wear off when you can start to take stock of what the problem was that drove you to drinking in the first place.
The underlying issues. Right. That's what they always bring up.
Now, of course there are underlying issues, right? I mean, but maybe some people don't have underlying issues because there's a lot of people who grew up, you know, not much trauma,
right?
You know, not too many negative experiences, but they start drinking and then it gets its claws into you, and then you know it becomes like a almost impossible to extricate yourself from that circle.
Yeah, I always felt like an imposter at some of these meetings and different rehabs because I really don't have a traumatic past. I'm going to disappoint everybody right now and tell you that I had a happy childhood. My parents were not divorced. They were basically friendly. They still are. And so what the hell am I doing here with people who are, you know, horrifically abused? And I always used to think, man, they have a reason to be using and drinking. So what is wrong with me? And, you know, based on This Naked Mind is a great book that Mike recommended to
me. That was the second book I read after Porter. Porter was sort of my entree into Annie Grace.
Which is along those same lines. And she's sort of saying that, like, it's a social and it's a media conglomerate marketing, you know, nightmare that we're really caught up in this, like, lie. That's just perpetrated by, you know, big alcohol, you could call it. And it's just sort of like you drink it when you first drink alcohol as a kid, the first time you taste it, you're like, this is disgusting. And she talks a lot about, like, before I had my first drink, I was happy all the time. Like, you know, I didn't need to drink to have a sleepover with my friends and have fun. And how did we get ourselves, you know, down this path where you finally make yourself like alcohol? Like, the whole idea of an acquired taste is interesting. And she brings that up.
Yeah. And then, your mind sort of takes over from there,
right?
Because, you know, some of the experiments that she did when she was quitting drinking, this is Annie Grace, the author, was she would, pour a drink and notice that the feeling of relief that she got, was, it came before she even took a sip of the drink.
Psychological. Yeah. I mean, I think we can all remember, maybe you can remember too, when you're on your way to meet your guy, you know, like if I was dope sick and I got that text, I'm about to roll up, you know, and if anyone ever got that text, I'm about to roll up, you know, it's like 25, 30 minutes if you're lucky. But the minute you're sitting in that parking lot or wherever you are set up to meet your guy, you immediately feel some relief from your withdrawal symptoms when your guy is about to roll up. And then he does, and then sometimes it's fake, you know, and you're like, motherfucker, you know. But yeah, you would definitely, it's, there's a lot of psychological, you know, the placebo effect is something like 40%. And that applies to drugs and drinking too, for sure.
Well, definitely with alcohol. I mean, the relaxing effect, I mean, alcohol has a physical effect, right? The relaxing effect that you get from a drink, a single unit, as they say, of alcohol lasts about 20 minutes.
Yes. I just listened to that this morning.
And then after that, a withdrawal kicks in and you start feeling anxious. Your body is trying to excise the poison.
Right.
So what it does is it releases stress hormones. It releases
it's an equal and opposite
epinephrine.
Reaction.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And so what do you do to get rid of that new rush of stress?
You have another drink.
Absolutely. And you watch this thing play out. You can get ahead of that stress reaction by having like a lot of drinks
just keep
really
drinking
quickly.
A lot fast.
But then you wake up the next morning and you have the the scaries, you know?
That, yeah, why do I feel like a truck hit me? Yeah.
It's not just that, but it's not just the physical, the throwing up, the stomach, you know, the headache, but it's the anxiety.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And what's the cure for anxiety? It's another drink.
It's right? another drink, absolutely. You know, that's definitely, you know, one of those things that... In the Naked Mind, she talks about it's, you know, you think you're making yourself better with alcohol, and you could apply this to any drug, honestly. And then it creates this, you know, effect of, but then you feel worse, and then you drink more, and you're even worse. And the next day, you feel so bad that, boy, I better have a drink. I mean, you've heard of hair of the dog. I'm not sure why that has ever become like a positive metaphor. Like what about hair on a dog is positive? When you're referring to alcohol, it's positive for alcoholics because right. hair of the dog, it's 6 a.m. You're sweating, you're throwing up. Well, gee, if I just have, you know, take a handle of vodka and take a few swigs, you'll feel better.
Right.
But do you really feel better?
Well, for 20 minutes.
At least for 20 minutes.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the other thing that she makes a big deal about, like, which I could relate to her experience, you know, after a night of drinking, you just sort of sit bolt upright in bed at 3 a.m. because all of that accumulated adrenaline and everything is now shooting through your brain like a rocket.
And alcohol, I have been told, turns into a stimulant in your system chemically. I don't know how true that is. I feel like it's something my father said that may not be true, but certainly you feel like you're sleeping better by drinking. I don't know if anyone out there has been there. You can't sleep. You have a couple shots, a nightcap.
Right.
It's even got a fancy name. But then you end up waking up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. And why are you sitting straight up? Because, you know.
Well, it's your body's reaction to the alcohol that's in there is because it's dumped all that shit into your bloodstream.
It's a poison.
So both Porter and Annie Grace, what kind of got me and hooked me more than anything had in the past was this whole idea that the drinking culture is not, it's not normal. It shouldn't be normalized because there's nothing really normal about it. Okay, so the big light bulb moment for me was when I realized that sobriety was not a state of deprivation. Mm. It wasn't that you can't have something. It was a state of power where you... Not drinking is a superpower because it takes you outside of that whole mind fuck of running around, like living your life, bouncing around from alcohol
drink to drink
event to alcohol event. And all of a sudden you take all that away.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's like an overnight thing.
No.
You get that realization and then you can kind of see it at work, you know,
like
at these work conferences, the part B that I wanted to talk about was, I would hang out with people that I've known for a decade and I would watch them get progressively more smashed. And it's really like, holy shit, is that what I look like?
Yeah. You know? Once you get sober, watching people drink is an experience.
You think, you know, when you're drinking that you're witty and you're, you're making all these connections, but really you're repeating yourself, slurring your words and looking like an absolute mess.
Absolutely. I was thinking about some of those times, you know, as you get sober and over time, I don't know if this happens to anybody else, but I will occasionally have like flashbacks to things I've said or did, you know, situations that have been blacked out in my memory, you know, for self-protection, for whatever, but they come back. I think getting clean, you know, those things start to come back and they horrify me. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about, I'm not even going to repeat it, but just thinking about those things. And sometimes I think, wow, I can't believe I'm alive. Sometimes I think I can't believe I survived that scenario, you know, and thank God I don't know that person anymore.
Thank God
they don't know anybody I know today.
Well, absolutely. There was a lot of stuff, you know, that went on when I was a young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed crackhead in the Bronx.
well, in crack's another story.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know if we brought this up last time. I don't think we did. But I had a pretty strident disagreement with a friend of mine who's been in recovery for a long time who was very into the whole the trauma theory of drug addiction and alcoholism, and you know, his argument is like, well, people have a lot of PTSD from trauma. And I'm thinking, you know, that's probably true in some cases.
Yeah.
But I said to him, I said, any PTSD I ever had from the drug use that I did was from the drug use itself. Because I'm a little suburban, white little suburban kid who ended up in going to college in the Bronx, wandering around in the South Bronx in the streets at 4 o'clock in the morning, being shot at, stabbed, you know, chased around. And, you know, to me, that'll give you the PTSD.
Yeah.
It's not the trauma that precipitated the drug use. It's exactly. Somebody chasing you with a machete through the Bronx at 3 o'clock in the morning.
So, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, there's definitely some traumatic episodes that I have created myself in my pursuit of drugs and alcohol over the years. And yeah, I think, you know, that's something that, recovering addicts ought to think about is that you are a survivor of trauma. I mean, there's a lot of situations, you know, I mean, even thinking about family fights with my wife, you know, from 10 years ago, those were traumatic. You know, the whole situation was traumatic. The situations we put ourselves in, you know, and what about that trauma? You know, should we be in therapy for that trauma? I mean, I would agree with that.
I'm a big proponent of therapy.
I love therapy. Ever since I was discharged from some of my court mandated therapy, I haven't delved back into it because of this the COVID-19. So I have a lot of excuses that why I haven't gone back to professional therapy. But that's not to say that I won't and that I don't believe in it, because I do. I think that, you know, recovered addicts, even if you haven't used or drank in a long time, or even if you have, you know, years of recovery and maybe you had a drink here and there, but you're still, you know, we're all suffering from our actions, especially if we were addicted. And I think, yeah, I highly recommend any kind of therapy. So I'm looking for it. I try and get it from, you know, doing this podcast is therapy for me. Just talking.
Absolutely.
Talking to your friends who have been through it as well. I get a lot out of other podcasts, listening to addiction recovery memoirs. You know, that's how I do it. I mean, did you immediately get started like looking for podcasts or
yes.
books?
I knew that I had to keep one. There are a lot of things that I like about the AA program.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We love AA. I love AA.
One of them that I really agree with is the idea of keeping your sobriety sort of right front and center. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, I try to engage with some kind of reading or some kind of, you know, podcast or something every single day.
Yeah.
So
keep
you don't
it in the forefront.
Track. Because there's so many people, there's a lot of people I know who, you know, they'll make it to an anniversary, like 90 days or 6 months and then feel like they're okay. They don't have a problem. So let's go celebrate 90 days with a drink.
Yes. You know? Yes.
I've
celebrating.
Been guilty of doing that myself.
Absolutely.
Occasionally in the past.
I can celebrate. Yeah.
But if you keep the sobriety right in front of your face, you know,
yeah,
you're less likely to do that.
That's true. I agree with that. You know, I'm also conflicted. Like, part of me, you know, I got clean, so I wouldn't have to deal with recovery and people in recovery and drug addicts and alcoholics. I don't want to see these people. No offense to you, Mike.
No, I get it, man.
I want out, you know, but that's something that has driven me back to using, because anything, and they say this in the program, and I don't have to abide the AA traditions because I am not an avowed member. Mm. So as far as anonymity is concerned, yes, I believe that the AA philosophy and a lot of the programs I've been to that weren't directly AA, anything you put above your sobriety or your recovery, you will lose. And I think that that's true. That's true. But on the other hand, I don't want to be at a meeting 3 days a week.
I mean, you don't have to obsess about it all day, every day. You know, that's the thing. You know, as long as you set aside time and there's a space in your head for it, and you know it's always there.
You cannot forget you know, what your weakness is.
Right.
You know?
Because I had some trepidation about doing this podcast because for that very reason, because I was thinking, you know, I got almost a year in and life's going great. And
why would I want to dredge the swamp, especially go back
and mine my drug stories from 1985?
That's going to be the best. But that's the selling point of this podcast, right? Is Mike's stories from the 80s. I can't wait to hear them.
I tell you, man, everybody's like probably waiting, you know, 45 minutes now for us to stop blathering on about recovery and start talking about, you
the
know,
crack years,
dodging bullets on Decatur Avenue.
And yes, it's coming. You just stay tuned.
We got to lay some groundwork.
Right, you know? Right. We're laying groundwork here.
Because, you know, when we first started talking about doing this podcast, I had shared with you that earlier in the year, I was thinking about putting something together. And the reason that I didn't, I actually recorded something. And the reason I decided not to go forward with it, or one of the reasons, aside from the fact that I would have had to narrate it in my house with all my family home from COVID, and I just didn't feel like doing that,
disaster.
Was I just didn't want to, you know, I don't want to use the word wallow, but I just didn't want to be so steeped in that all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. I know what you're saying. And though this is episode two, so far, I feel like we're not like obsessing about it on a daily basis. I feel like everything we're thinking about for the show, it builds up over the week. And then this is like an outlet.
Yeah.
You know, so.
A healthy outlet.
Yeah, so far.
Yeah.
You know, so far, so good. You know, the only unhealthy thing is our wives' reactions to it. But
well, listen, my wife was thrilled that you called her cool three times in like the first half an hour. So
I will call her cool a fourth time.
She's a big fan. I need to get her to leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Yes. Like all of you should.
Yes,
if you're still here, if you're still listening after 46 minutes.
If you're still here. My wife was sort of like, how come Mike didn't say those things about his marriage? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know about his marriage. But
my wife's awesome.
She didn't like the word. I think I used the adjective murderous to describe our relationship. I said, honey, it's just shtick. There you go. I said, it's all shtick.
That's it.
Now that, listen, I single-handedly saved our relationship by getting sober. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that. Absolutely. Anybody knows who's been in recovery that your family comes along for the ride for better or worse. And the miracle that we are still married with kids that, you know, I'm legally allowed to be around. I mean, I've been binge watching Hard Times on Amazon, and this is a show National Geographic created about, it's just like they follow inmates in prisons around. And this, I do this once in a while. I just start to get obsessed with the show and then I watch it nonstop. And so I'm like watching these guys, they're in prison, and all it does is make me like grateful that I'm not in prison, and just to look at those, like things could be so much worse. And I know that's such a, people say that all the time, but it really could.
It really could.
And when you look back, when I look back on how close I came, I'll tell a quick story. Close. I almost had a felony. Let me tell you how I almost. Can I do my almost had a felony story?
Go ahead.
Okay. So I was on probation. It was misdemeanor probation for my DWI. And over those, it was 3 years. Ended up being 3.5 because I violated. But that's another story. I was also at that time not clean, even though I was in all kinds of programs. I was still smoking crack and drinking. I don't remember if there was heroin at that point, but definitely crack because I was walking from the train station to the probation officer's office, right? And I had my crack and my crack pipe in my jacket. And in the other pocket, I had my fake piss that I got at Utopia, you know, so that I could pass whatever I had to pass at the outpatient place that I was headed to after probation.
Well equipped.
I had everything I needed. And so I'm walking there and I think to myself, I take a hit of crack walking down, I can't remember the name of that road in Mineola. And then I look at it, and I didn't have any left. And I said, man, I should not walk into probation with like a used crack pipe.
Probably a wise.
Thank God that I had that ray of light, because I took it out. I put it on like a tree, you know, near there. You know, they have these trees that they plant. Anyway, I put it in, walked in, and that was the very day that they were taking me in for my violation. So,
unbeknownst to you, you did not know.
Look, I had no idea. Yeah. I knew that I had violated, and it was weird because the probation officer was like, listen, because I had a dirty urine, and the officer's like, listen, this is the last time I'm going to let you, you know, piss dirty. We're going to have to violate you. I said, oh, okay, fine. What do I know? He says, we'll send you a letter. Someone will come to your house. So long story short, a month goes by and I'm going in. I had really forgotten about it. But that day he said, listen, I get in there filing to meet with him. He says, I got to take you in. Mm. I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, violation. I said, yeah, I haven't gotten my letter yet. No one's called me. He goes, yeah, I know. Wait right there. And I was like, oh, shit.
What, did he go print you a letter?
Like, worse.
Here's the letter.
Worse than printing a letter, he brought in a much larger man with a badge and handcuffs.
Oh, that's a bummer.
They handcuffed me, took me to the back of the probation office, handcuffed me to literally a radiator. And I'm like, oh, what is going on? What is happening? They're very nice, I have to say.
That's their plan, though? Like, I just have to say, like, they take you in and they handcuff you to a radiator.
That was it. I'm in the back of the probation office.
I think they have a little cell or something.
No, there's no cell at probation. I don't know that I know of, but I was handcuffed to a radiator and I'm sitting there. They let me make a phone call, but then they went through all of my stuff. Right. I had an overcoat. It was cold out, and they pull out the fake piss, which was not for probation. Cause let me just say to everyone, I never came up with like an effective way to fake a piss test at probation, because they're very good there at staring at your penis. At outpatients, that was fine. I had plenty of ways to get away with it. But I had this fake piss. It was not intended for probation. In any case, it was on me. And so the officer took it out of my, and he looked at me. It was my probation officer. An angel of a guy. I loved him, believe it or not. And he just looked at me. He goes, what is this? And I go, I'm like, officer, it's a fake piss. And he goes, he just shook his head. He's like, you got anything else on you? And I was like, no, I don't. There's no crack pipe that I hit outside. And if I, just, you know, going back, if I had a crack pipe and it was used, that is a felony.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Is that true?
I don't know.
I'm not, you know, it is. And it's because I've had other addicts who told me that. But
just for residue, it's a felony.
Yes. Hmm. I mean, you can buy these crack pipes. They have a little rose in them. Some of you may be nodding your heads right now at a gas station. You can buy them, but if you get caught with them, the residue, it's a felony. So I went to jail that night, but it was just jail. You know, I didn't have a boyfriend named Bubba or anything like that. Right. And the vegan bologna was disgusting.
Is it really vegan bologna?
There's no meat.
Oh.
I forget why, but everything is not meat. It's all
probably
vegan.
Not a good reason.
No, there's no reason. But I mean, I just narrowly escaped really having a felony in my record for life.
Yeah.
And that is a close call, and there are many others.
Your higher power was looking after you.
Yes, she was. And I just tell that story to sort of, I want to just inspire my recording partner here that, you know, like, I've laid one out for you. I've got some worse ones that I'm going to, that'll come out, but, you know, we're it's a give and a take here. So yeah. That's one of my good ones.
Okay, that's a good one. Can I just back up for a little second?
Back up.
You just kind of let something slide through there that bears reinvestigation.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you bought the urine at Utopia.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you need some synthetic urine?
No, but this is something. So
is this an ad for Utopia?
For those of you who don't know, Utopia is a head shop.
Yes.
In the Long Island area.
The head shop.
It has been around since your parents were following the Grateful Dead in the early 70s.
It's awesome.
It's weird. There's a sex shop downstairs.
Sex shop, you know, is awesome.
The first floor, you go in there and it's like you can buy tie dyes and stickers and something.
And Manic Panic hair dye.
Yeah, right. Yeah. All that stuff. It's like just a gaudy Spencer Gifts almost. But then if you go downstairs, that's where the real shit goes down.
You have
down.
To have an ID to get down there. You have to be 18.
I had no idea that you could purchase urine there, though.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. And it worked. Anytime I was able to pass it off, and I won't go into details on how you do that, you can email me at netx@newreligiousrecovery.com if you need details. And it was like it passed lab tests. If you could push that past, and I don't know if there's addicts out there who have been through this, you know, if you can get this, you know, it's way easier if you're trying to keep using to freeze your own, you know. And listen, I've done that too. You get sober long enough to freeze some urine in your freezer. But this,
that's some crazy ass advanced planning, though.
It is. I mean, you have to be. Listen, I was on probation.
Also, you have to tell your wife which ice cube tray you gotta.
Yeah,
stay
I mean
away
that's
from.
It's a whole. I mean, think of all the planning and think of all the energy that we put. That I'll put it in the eye here. That I put into getting away with things, man, and I could be in a very different spot, but and that's one of the times. Yeah, so fake urine utopia, but the way you get by with it, you've all heard of the Wizinator, which I have never seen one, but this is a prosthetic penis. Somehow this is attached to a heated bladder that's like taped to your leg. I've never seen one, but I always heard stories in outpatient. You know, this is one of those myths.
That's something they should sell at Utopia if they don't already.
I think they probably do.
They have to, right?
Where else are you getting
a
Wizinator?
If you buy the urine in, I would think they would try and sell you the Wizinator at the same time.
They should. I mean, I always thought it would be funny because, you know, if I got like a really big one, you know, like a really big black one, and then set it up, and then I went in for a urine test, and just to see if they would like, what are they going to say? Like, here I am, and just whip it out, and it's this... You know, so I never actually did that because they're about $100. I looked into it.
Gosh. Who can afford $100 for a fake?
Yeah, this. Well, mostly it's stockbrokers. Right. It's stockbrokers. Yeah. You know, they're the ones that buy the giant Wizinators.
All right. Well, that's a good story. And yeah, so, you know, we can lead off next time.
Next time? How long have we been going?
56 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
So we didn't even get to half of the shit. Yeah. We didn't even get to recovery in the news segment.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I had a great story. I thought this would be funny. American flag destroyed by Bigfoot. A Bigfoot researcher in Nebraska believes that a famed cryptid may have been behind a mysterious incident in which American flag at a cemetery wound up inexplicably destroyed. I really wanted to talk about that. I printed it out and everything.
Is that somehow related to recovery in
not,
some way?
Not at all. But I had this like passing idea. I'm like, you know, it'd be really funny to do like a recovery podcast and then do some one of these really wacky like paranormal news stories. So it's actually a horrible idea now that I've done it.
LSD involved.
Yeah. Though. So there it is, guys. If you want to know more about an American flag destroyed by Bigfoot.
All right.
Just email us at MikeR@middleagesrecovery.com or NatX@middleagesrecovery.com.
You can send emails, you can send compliments, you can send death threats, whatever you want. Just do reach out.
We'd love to hear from everybody. Yeah. And when I mean say everybody, I mean all 10 to 15 of you?
Three dozen, right?
At least three dozen, but hopefully nobody that actually knows who we are locally besides your wives.
Maybe they'll put us in the Memorial Day Parade next year.
Yes. So as we say here at Recovery in the Middle Ages, non proficiat perfectum.
Progress, not perfection.
That's it.
All right.
And we'll see you next week, guys.
Be good. We'll be right back.